The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 152.
Math, Magic, and Language. Interview with Yunha Lee.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And obviously our special guest today is Yunha Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So since you've never been here before, we're going to ask you the one question we ask every author who first shows up, which is what led you into writing and why science fiction and fantasy in particular?
I had a third grade teacher who really pushed writing as a way of expressing creativity. And I was not really imaginative at the time in the sense that I thought stories just sort of appeared out of the ether. It never occurred to me that actual human beings made stories. So when I learned that human beings made stories, I thought, well, this is something that maybe I could do, and I decided to become a writer. I didn't decide to write science fiction until high school, which was when I read Ender's Game, and I really liked the whole military science fiction thing. And I was like, I would like to write science fiction that raises the kinds of ethical questions that Card did in that novel.
Oh, excellent. So you would say that Orson Scott Card was kind of the defining book for what drew you to science fiction then?
Yes.
That's a good place to start, I think. So as a kind of just a jumping off point to go straight into the book, one of the things that I've really was interested in is a lot of these stories, and hopefully this doesn't make me sound like an idiot, but have a clear sort of Asian influence. There's a lot of references to calligraphy, which certain sort of mythical things, such as the story Swan Watch, for example, has this kind of very mythical dimension to it, which I thought was really interesting. And I'm curious. Hopefully this isn't a stupid question, but where exactly are you drawing sort of your influences for these kinds of stories with this, what seems to me to be a very clear Asian influence?
I didn't start writing stories that had Asian influence until several years into my writing career when people on LiveJournal were talking about cultural appropriation and how so many stories were Western-centric. And I had grown up reading, you know, Heinlein and Asimov and Larry Niven and a lot of writers who were, you know, Western writers. And so the science fiction that I wrote was kind of an imitation of them, but it didn't reflect my heritage. I'm Korean American, and I spent about 9 years in South Korea growing up. So when I realized that I had cut out this entire side of myself from my fiction, I was like, well, hey, I grew up with stories of shape-shifting foxes and very, very hungry shape-shifting tigers. And this is all material that I can draw on for my fiction, and it's also material that is not really mined very often in English language science fiction that I've been able to see. I mean, it's a lot better now than when I was reading stuff 20 years ago, but it still is not, you know, it's not a majority influence.
Julia? Oh, I'm sorry. I should have explained this. I'll cut this out. Because there's three of us, we're going to do a hand system so that basically, whenever you finish with your whenever you finish with your particular answer, that person will just jump in, whoever's got the hand up. That way we don't have like people trying to talk over each other.
Okay.
Sorry, I should have defined that before. I didn't say that. So sorry, go ahead, Julia.
Okay, so aside from the Korean influences, which are obviously all throughout, and I actually have a question about those too, I noticed that a lot of your stories, if not all of them, but at least most of them, seem to have female protagonists. And I wonder, the influence that you mentioned growing up, Orson Scott Card, Heinlein, Asimov, those aren't known for having female protagonists as much. Did you start out always writing with female protagonists, or was that something that also sort of became a thing that you did deliberately after thinking about that?
I think I mostly started out with female protagonists because I noticed that women were and girls were not represented very well, and I don't identify as female myself, but I found it annoying on a parody basis. And so I actually keep a list every so often that I update, and I write down all my protagonists or major characters. And I mean, this is really fuzzy. It's hard to say who's the main character sometimes, but I keep a count of how many female characters there are versus how female main characters versus male main characters. And I really want to weight it towards female characters because I feel like male characters already get a lot of representation.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, and I love that your female characters do have all sorts of exciting adventures, and it doesn't seem to be sexualized, which is awesome. Going back to the Korean thing, I noticed that at least a couple of times it seemed like there were stories that were based on Admiral Yi, and I was not previously familiar with Admiral Yi. I did not grow up with any Korean influences in my life. So I was wondering if you would tell us a little bit more about your experiences learning about him as a child that led you to write about him.
Admiral Yi was like one of the first two generals, or I guess the title is translated as admiral, but the Joseon Korean military was a unified service, so you could sort of be switched between the Navy and the Army. They were considered the same service. So anyway, the first two generals I grew up knowing about weren't like the really, you know, Napoleon or whatever. It was Admiral Yi because he's a Korean national hero. He drove out the Japanese in the invasion from 1592 to 1598. And the other one is actually General Douglas MacArthur because of the Incheon landing during the Korean War. And my parents would tell me about that story. And, you know, there's a statue to General MacArthur in Incheon. And I've been there, and it's just, I think, something that especially the generation of Koreans who remember the Korean War or who grew up in its shadow really, really keep in mind. But Admiral Yi was, he was remarkable because he was really honest and really forthright, and he got in a lot of political trouble because he refused to play political games. And he was also a brilliant tactician and strategist. He did not lose any of his sea battles. Basically, he died in his last battle, but that last battle drove the Japanese out until, you know, they came in several centuries later. And I think Admiral Yi is not really familiar to many people in the West because, I mean, he's kind of local. It's a Korean thing. The thing that people may have heard about is the turtle boats or turtle ships, which is kind of funny. They're often known as the first ironclads, although there's some scholarly dispute as to whether they were ironclad at all. And they were not the absolute deciding factor in a lot of battles because there simply were not very many of them.
I feel stupid right now because I did not. I know so little about this region of the world, and now I've got like my Wikipedia page open.
Me too, Sean.
I'm like, I want to know who this guy is.
But I mean, I spent 9 years in Korea, so it's kind of natural that I would know about him. I don't really expect people who, you know, don't have a connection to Korea to know about him. If you asked me about Lithuanian military history, I wouldn't be able to tell you anything about that. I just don't know.
So he's a figure that's I'm guessing he's talked about quite a lot in the local area.
Yes.
This is really interesting. I have a friend who is in, she's teaching in South Korea right now, and now I'm going to ask her, just out of curiosity, if she's heard what she's heard about from the kind of people that she spoke with. Obviously, she didn't speak Korean, so I imagine she's speaking with only a select number of people, but that's just really interesting, that historical reference I just didn't pick up. This actually really comes up with another question I'm curious about. Since you said that you had lived in Korea for 9 years, other than the cultural influences in terms of the sort of the history, et cetera, would you say that experience has at all influenced you as a writer?
It's hard to say because I had a Western education. I went to Department of Defense schools in Korea, and then I went to an international private school where it was basically a Western curriculum. So while I had, I'm not actually fluent in Korean myself. So I can get some of the stories and the history and the folklore in my conversations with my mom, because my mom knows how bad my Korean is and she will gloss things for me. But, can I read a Korean novel? Not really.
It's interesting. Okay. So, and kind of to jump back to the stories, I thought was really interesting in a lot of your stories, there's this attempt to kind of meld or blend the technological with the fantastic or mystical. And I think that probably the most obvious one, or at least my favorite story of the whole lot, which is Ghost Weight, in which when you're inside the kite ships, there's all of these, the way the visual system works is described as like tapestries with, depending on what is going on outside, there are crows or there's wolves and things like that. I was really interested in what was kind of the impetus behind melding so seamlessly these two seemingly disparate worlds?
Well, in the case of the tapestries, I guess, is that I usually write in secondary worlds. They're not like a future Earth gone out to space or whatever. And so what this implies to me is that these people will have really vastly different cultures, or maybe not vastly different. I don't do the CJ Cherry thing. I'm not really good at drawing alien cultures. But if you have a culture that is not an offshoot of our own, it really occurred to me that their interface design would be different. It would come from different principles because they wouldn't make the same assumptions. Like, their computers wouldn't have windows and tabs and little X's in the corners for closing windows and that kind of thing. The other thing that I draw on for melding technology and sort of a more fantastical thing, I guess, is that it became clear to me very early on that there are a lot of science fiction writers who have a very strong background in, say, engineering or one of the sciences or something technical. I'm a math major, and I sort of bailed out early. I became a math teacher, and I didn't pursue a doctorate in the subject. But if you want me to talk about stuff like ion ramjets or, I don't know, lasers or supernovas or whatever, I'm not going to be able to compete with all these other people on that field, and I would rather change it to a battlefield where I can win by defining the rules. So that's kind of where that comes from.
That's fantastic. Paul, you had your hand?
I did. I was going to ask you about the math theme that seems to run through a lot of the stories, but you already answered that question. But this is a more allied to that topic. I noticed in several of the stories there's a theme of games. The Unstrung Zither, the Black Abacus, all revolve around games. I was wondering if that came from your math background or from your own interest in board games and strategy and the mathematical aspects of games.
I have been interested in games since I was a child. I tried to design a few games, which were really pretty terrible. And that was before I became interested in math. I hated math until ninth grade because math was stupid and pointless, and you had to do all these computations, and if you got one step wrong, everything went wrong. But I've had an interest in game design and sort of, you know, where do games come from? How do you make them balanced? What do you do with them? How do you teach with them? How can you tell a story with them? These are all questions that I've found really interesting. And I guess that's where I get that from.
Are you a fan of Greg Egan by any chance?
I'm sorry?
Of the author Greg Egan.
I have read and liked a couple of his stories, yes.
Because I was thinking particularly of one of his story, Border Guards, in relation to the Black Abacus, and I was thinking, I wonder if she's read that, because that's an intersection of math and games and science fiction. I see the resonances in both of your works.
I am going to have to look that story up. That sounds fantastic.
It's actually really interesting that you almost make the distinction that, a lot of other science fiction writers who consider themselves, you know, at least what we would call the hard science fiction writers, they deal with the quote-unquote hard sciences like physics. But yet your field is mathematics, and obviously this is at the root of everything. I mean, nothing else works without understanding any mathematics. And so in some very interesting way, since math is clearly, as you've kind of described, is at least part of a lot of your stories in some way, it's almost like you rewrite the world using, like thinking about rewriting the world as though you're using the math as the rewriting the math, changing 2 plus 2 to equal 12 or something. That's not a question. That's just me rambling about something I found interesting. I mean, did you have anything, if you had a comment on that ramble, I mean, that's perfectly fine.
I like to get my metaphors and my imagery from math because that's what I find familiar. And also, I feel like math has the purest sense of wonder that I've ever experienced. I think I've told other people this, but in high school, there's this footnote to Roger Penrose's The Emperor's New Mind, which you shouldn't read because it's really incoherent and tries to explain consciousness from quantum physics principles. It's incoherent. But anyway, it has a footnote about Cantor's diagonal slash proof. And what it says is that the counting numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, are actually, even though they're an infinite set, they're a smaller kind of infinite set than the real numbers, which include things like the square root of 2 and pi and decimals and so on. And I remember staring at that proof until I understood it. And then it was this really beautiful thing. It was a construction of pure thought. And I'm not a mathematician myself, but I try to convey some of that in my stories, and I sort of hope that even people who don't enjoy math themselves will be able to see that it can be beautiful. I guess that's the math teacher in me. I want to proselytize the subject.
Well, algebra is the best subject in math, just so everybody knows. I only say that because I got an A in algebra, and I was really good at it, so... Julie, I saw you had your hand up.
Yeah, so as someone who has always struggled with math, and the only thing I've ever been even remotely good at was geometry, I have to say that something that struck me about reading this, all of your stories in collection together, I'd read many of them before in the various venues where they'd appeared, but reading them all at once sort of brought home the striking similarity that runs through all of them, that seems to be like a fascination with both math and language, but a fascination with language that manifests in a sort of technical way. And I don't know if I'm even articulating that correctly, but as far as I can tell, people seem to love language in kind of two different ways. There are people like me who, I am very intuitive. I just like to hear and feel the shapes of words, and I don't really think about the technicalities of how the sentences are constructed. I just sort of go for what feels right. And then there seem to be people who take such deliberate care in crafting things. And I noticed that one of the stories you said you wrote after you'd read Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, I think he's another person who very much obviously understands language on a deeply technical level that I just don't, and I don't study linguistics, and I never have, and I'm in awe of people who do that. But it made me wonder if your love of math and your love of language kind of go hand in hand, and if so, like, is that something that you notice, or is that just something that maybe I'm making up?
No, I'm very conscious of it, and I actually like to bring in a third thing, which is not really as visible in the collection, which is music. I compose as a hobby. And in each of these cases, you're juggling with structures and you're doing a lot of combinatorial work, by which I mean, you know, you put in one word in the sentence and that leads to several possibilities. So you pick another one that you think will lead to more, you know, it's just sort of this chain reaction until you get the effect that you want. And at first, when I started doing this, I originally did not write in a really technical way. It wasn't until I read Roger Zelazny and Patricia McKillop that in high school that I realized that writing could be beautiful. And I said, I want to write beautifully. And I assume there's a way to sit down and learn how to do this. So I set out to study how the language in works I admired was put together. And really, you go down to word choice and you go down into the bones of the sentence and you put it together. And that's pretty much the same way I compose. The nice thing is that it sounds laborious to have to go down into detail in this way, but the more you do it, the faster it goes, because, you know, if there's a bad word choice, you become faster and faster at recognizing it and rejecting it and going after something that works better.
Okay, and I see, Sean, that you have your hand up, but I'm going to follow up on this really quickly before I get back to you. And that's the longest story in this collection is one that has never appeared anywhere else, which is Zoll's Lexicon. And that one, you said in the notes that that was the hardest story you'd ever written. That's also very deeply to do with language and linguistics. Can you tell us a little bit about the making of that one and why it was the hardest and how you think you did?
Oh, it was partly because I was physically sick while I was writing it, but partly because I had a real hard time nailing down the plot in an order that made it fire correctly, because I had to have the heroine discover things about her own world's magic system in a certain sequence for the climax to go off the way I wanted it to. And usually when I write a story, I start with, what do I want the ending to say? You know, I often feel that you can kind of muff the beginning of a story a little and readers may forgive you, but you really have to nail the ending. Like, you cannot get the ending wrong, because that's what they come away with if they bother finishing, you know, if they bother finishing it out. So in this case, it was just lining up all these elements to get that ending to come out right. And the other thing is, I think it's 19,000 words, which is not, it's a weird in-between length for me. I usually write at 5,000 words to 10,000 words, or I'm not a published novelist, but I have written novels, so I can write at the 100,000 words length, but 20,000 words, it was just hard to get the structure to work because I was not used to working at that length.
I'm sorry, I got really excited. I was looking through the notes and I'm like, oh man, I want to teach one of these stories next semester. Sorry, just so you know.
I think you should go for that, John.
Oh, I am. I just got to figure out which one now, and I'm not sure which one. Because Ghost Weight is I love Ghost Weight because of the kind of origami aspect of it with the kite ship. I just thought that was so fascinating. But yet at the same time, I do think that some of the other stories really would work in very different ways depending on how I work. I'm sorry. I'm rambling about crap. That doesn't matter. Shut up now. But this actually, one of the things that you'd mentioned earlier, and I was really fascinated about this when you mentioned music, because Swan Watch is the one story that is heavily focused on music. And I was really fascinated by this idea of creating almost like a prison of sorts in which, you know, somebody who for whatever reason has broken the rules and gets exiled is sent to this place where they can't leave until they in the case of the main character, composes a masterpiece, which you can imagine how that's got to be because of what a masterpiece entails. And of course, the other characters have to do other artistic endeavors, but that's kind of the point. And I was really fascinated because there is a lot of attention paid to the kind of the process of music, although not as much. It mentions in your story notes that I guess one of your betas said there was too much musical theory, so you got to back it up a bit. But I was really interested in what compelled you to think of using art in this way as a I hesitate to say punishment, although that's kind of the implication, at least.
Well, I have bipolar disorder, and one of the things that I really hate about talking to people about bipolar disorder is that there's the whole Kay Redfield Jamison, a psychologist, thing about how bipolar people are more creative, and it's a blessing, too. And I don't actually feel very blessed. It's a terrible disorder. I'm actually currently in partial hospitalization, which means you go to a hell of a lot of therapy during the day. So, you know, it's a disorder that's just not a lot of fun. It's very disruptive to your life. It's disruptive to your loved ones. And when I look at creativity, I don't know how it works for other creative people. I can only speak for myself, but it actually causes me pain as much as it is fulfilling, I guess. I have nights where I can't sleep because the ideas will not stop in my head. It's called racing thoughts. It's pretty common in bipolar disorder. I am a perfectionist, which is a terrible, terrible trait to have because I can't stop until I get things right. And of course, there's no such thing as perfection in a work of art, or at least not at my level. So there's a lot about art that I think it's expressive and it can be beautiful and it can tell truth about the world, but it's also the process of creating it really hurts me sometimes. And so I guess that's where that comes from.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was intense.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's great. No, I mean that's really actually I appreciate it. And it does actually it sort of changes how I think about the story as almost like a metaphor for not just your personal kind of journey with art, but even maybe for people who that the struggle with art in itself is almost it's like an extended metaphor in a way. Sorry, Julia, you had a hand. I'm just making a comment. So, Julia.
Well, no, I mean, I think that artists definitely struggle with art in a variety of ways, and I would definitely agree, not having bipolar disorder myself, but knowing other people who are close to me who do, like, this is definitely something that I think is a horrible disorder and does disrupt a person's life and the lives of the people that they're around. So I'm right there with you on that one, Yoon. Going back to the content of the stories, though, the last story in the collection is Conservation of Shadows, the title story. And that one is, it was interesting to me because it seemed like a marked shift from the tone and the content of the other stories being about Inanna's descent. And in the notes, it said that you had been interested in that story ever since you were a child. And I was also noticing in the notes that you said you had dialed the prose up, which is something that you're usually uncomfortable with doing. What was interesting to me was that I thought the prose was beautiful and I didn't think that there was anything wrong with it. So I wondered why that would make you self-conscious on the one hand. And also I wondered, what is it about that story that you've always loved? And why did you have to come back to it and write your own take on it?
I first encountered Inanna's Descent because I had a really excellent 8th grade social studies teacher, and that was during the ancient Middle Eastern unit. And he told the story so compellingly that I felt that I had to go to the library and look it up and read a translation of the whole thing. And years later, I encountered more references to Sumerian Akkadian mythology in the poetry of Sonia Taaffe. None of the dedications, some of the stories are dedicated to people, but they weren't reprinted in the collection. Sonia Taaffe's poetry reminded me of how much I love that poem. And so when I wrote that story, I dedicated it to her. And I dialed the language up because Sonia's poetry has this really sharp, rich, lush vividness to it. I've never been able to even really describe it adequately, but I admire it tremendously, and I wanted to sort of pay an homage to it. I mean, I don't know if that was very successful, but that was where that story came from. That was the intent.
That's I thought it was beautiful, and actually now that you say that it was for Sonia, that makes sense, because Sonia's poetry does have the same sort of mythic quality a lot of the time. So I think you did a great job.
Paul?
Yeah. I noticed that a couple of the stories that you mentioned are directly influenced by anime, Bones of Giants, Book of Locked Doors. I was wondering if anime in general is something that's influenced your writing or influenced your writing process or how you think about construction of stories and characters.
I started watching anime in college when the guy who is now my husband dragged me to the anime club and introduced me to it. Before that, I had pretty much not been familiar with it. But I really enjoyed it because the aesthetic was different, the themes were different. It had lots of explosions and giant robots, which I personally find very fulfilling. Bones of Giants was, oh God, this is so embarrassing to admit, but I wrote it for Rachel Brown, who is a friend of mine, and she was the one who introduced me to an anime called Gundam Wing. Which,
yes!
Yes!
So the two characters are based on Hiro Yui and a gender-flipped duo Maxwell, which is why Sakura, the necromancer who travels with the hero, is always so cheerful, because duo is always so cheerful. So it was kind of a joke.
Oh my gosh, I got so happy right now. Duo Maxwell is my favorite character of Gundam Wing.
I love Duo. I don't know, when people ask me about influences, I kind of feel like they want me to say Tolstoy or something, and I'm like, I don't get my influences from that. I used to get my influences from Dragonlance in middle school. It's from what I enjoy and what's around me. So anime and Gundam Wing and giant robots, yeah. The other story, Book of Locked Doors, it didn't really directly take stuff from the influence, which was Code Geass. But Code Geass is about Japan, sort of this alternate Japan, being occupied by the Britannian Empire, which has this horrible sort of social Darwinism thing going on. And ironically, because of the Japanese occupation of Korea, I found this kind of a theme that resonated with me, and that was why I wrote a story sort of sideways influenced by Code Geass.
Is any other work besides those two explicitly influenced by anime in any way?
The Unstrung Zither is also the Five Assassins. That was also taken from Gundam Wing.
Okay.
And so the crazy Phoenix General, or whatever his name was, is based on Trez, who I apologize to any Trez Krishnanatra, or I can't pronounce the name, but I apologize to any Trez fans, but I find Trez sort of like crazy and incomprehensible, and that's why that character is a little bit odd.
He is a little bit weird. Yeah, no, he's, yeah, no, I can see it. Yeah. Yeah, he's not my favorite. oh my gosh, I did want to make a comment, because you'd said earlier, like, you know, that if people expect you to say you're influenced by Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and, you know, big names. And I think it's totally legitimate to say, no, I got my influences from, you know, Gundam Wing. And then what's interesting is, like, I imagine a lot of people just look at Gundam Wing and they go, that's just a cartoon. But if anyone's ever watched Gundam Wing all the way through, it's actually a really complicated show. And it's, got a lot of really interesting things to suggest about the nature of power. You know, the story is about an extended conflict between one paradigm of power and another paradigm of power, and it's all the kind of complex interrelationships and what happens to people who are turned into assassins, and it's really fascinating. And this is all a show that's basically meant for kids.
Yeah, I'm a bad parent. I let my daughter watch it when she was like, what, 5? She really loved Hiro.
He's a psychopath, though.
I know. He was my daughter at the time. I don't think she remembers now, but she really shipped Hiro and Relena, which I found very disturbing. But, you know, I guess maybe she'll grow out of it, or maybe she won't.
Probably not. No, she'll probably look at that always and go, oh, that's wonderful, yay. And it's like, he's kind of abusive. I don't know. But she loves him anyway, because she sees the goodness in his heart. Or something like, I'm not sure she actually sees the goodness in his heart. I think she knows he's a killer and she doesn't care. Yeah. I don't know. I always found that relationship really, yeah. But anyway, sorry. Totally. And Julie's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't watch Gundam Wing.
I've never seen it, but I do know other people who watch it. I'm familiar with the general premise.
It's an amazing show. It's one of the greatest anime ever made. I think it's what introduced me to anime, that I watched that show, and I got so mad when Toonami on Cartoon Network, when they took it off, I was so angry. I was so mad, even though I'd watched it like 3 times through, but you know, whatever.
I think my introduction to anime, like one of the first anime I saw, was the Evangelion movies, like the ones at the very end. So it made no sense whatsoever, but it was riveting nonetheless. See, it's giant robots and alien things that sort of with technology based on the Kabbalah or whatever it was they were doing in there, and lots of blood and gore. This totally explains why certain kinds of anime appeal to me.
My first introduction to anime was when I was a very small child, and I believe like it was the first time we had gotten cable and we had HBO, and the English translation of it was called Warriors of the Wind, and it was the Miyazaki movie that is not at all called Warriors of the Wind. Nausicaa.
Oh, okay.
Nausicaa. Yes. So there's this English dub that he has disavowed all connection with. He hated it. I watched that as a child, and I was just like, anytime it was on, I'd be like, what is this thing? It's amazing. It's got giant bugs.
It's an interesting film. Huh.
So basically, I'm just saying, I'm not looking down at anybody for watching anime.
No, and a lot of it's so weird because in Japan, my understanding, in Japan, like, anime is, like, that's the primary television. Maybe that's not the right way to put it. There's so much anime, like, in the same way that there are so many new damn TV shows on our network TV, there's so many new anime every year. I don't know how to describe it. Just that anytime I've been to an anime convention, I'm always so lost because everyone's dressed as these characters, and I'm like, I don't even know who you are. And they're like, oh, that's because you don't follow fan subs. I'm like, well, that's because there are 8,000 new shows every week. Mm. I can't follow. I'm sorry. I've got a life. I got other things I have to do, like work. I'm sorry. One of the things I did want to ask, since we were on the subject of anime, is what are you currently enjoying at the moment?
I am currently enjoying something called Valvrave the Liberator, which in the very first episode features war, of course, giant robots, and vampiric body hopping. Also high school students who, because of the war situation, are left stranded and have to defend their sort of portion of the colony or whatever. It's extremely cracky, but it's a lot of fun.
Have you seen Gun Parade March?
No, I have not.
Okay, it's got giant robots. But you should know. Lots of
That's unusual for anime.
I know, so unusual. There's not that many, you know. They're very uncommon.
So this actually leads me into another question about the content of Yoon's story collection.
How refreshing.
Right. So You've mentioned in the notes that in fiction you always love a good apocalypse. I think that was in the notes for Blue Ink, but it seems to me that a good apocalypse features in several of your stories. And I'm wondering, what to you makes a good apocalypse? What is your favorite apocalypse that you've written about in a story? What's one that you hope to write about in the future?
That I've written about? Sheesh, I don't think I've written one that rates. And while I'm admitting my influences, Blue Ink was a response to the ending of Angel, which is why there's rain. I know, that's terribly obscure.
Okay, can you explain that, please?
Yeah, because at the end of... Do we care about spoilers? It's been off the air for ages.
I think it's been off the air for ages now. You can totally just talk about whatever you want.
Okay.
If not, they're warned by now, so...
I mean, at the end of Angel, you have this whole thing about how they're going to stop the Circle of the Black Thorn, even though it's a completely meaningless gesture because they're just going to kill some of the figureheads of power and then evil will go on in the world just as before. So, you know, it's this gigantic gesture of meaninglessness because that is how Angel, I mean, I love Angel, but I don't love him for his brains because he doesn't really have any. And they have this whole thing where they're going off and they're going to trigger the apocalypse in the localized way of the Buffyverse because you only have an apocalypse in a specific city at a time. And you have Illyria, who I got the blue girl from. And so I was like, well, this is really stupid. I mean, I like apocalypses, but this is not the right way to go about one. You should, I don't know, aim for something better with your apocalypse. And so in Blue Ink, what I wanted to do was challenge that. Like, look, you have this guy, this leader, and his blue woman, blue henchwoman, this trying to fight this last fight for a cause that's never even really explained. And this high school girl is like, why do we even have to do this? So it was I actually like the ending of Angel as it stands because it's perfectly in character for Angel and his friends to do that. It's how they roll. They do a lot of stupid things over the course of that show because they all have a lot of personal damage. But I was like, well, why don't we explore it the other way?
What would you say are some of your favorite apocalypses, whether in literature or film?
Oh, God. My mind is going blank.
Oh, no, I asked the one question she can't answer. Dang me. Okay, well, it's obviously not 2012.
Evangelion.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting one. Yeah. Confusing towards the end of the show, but...
See, I watched the movie first, so that's what I always think of as the actual ending.
What's really interesting about it is the guy who wrote that show, he goes to Fanime, which is an anime convention in San Jose, California. And I think he still goes there every year, and he always gets questions about the end of the TV series, because there are a few episodes that are apparently really confusing. Mm-hmm. And people are always asking him to explain, like, well, what does this mean? He's got to a point where basically he just intros himself whenever he's there to talk. He says, I'm not going to answer any questions about those episodes because I don't know what they mean either. Because it's one of those shows where stuff happens and you're like, what? What? Yeah. So, but that's a good choice. I think it's a good choice. So one of the questions, I kind of want to go backwards a little bit if people don't mind. One of the interesting things I thought about the Bones of Giants, and this goes to, I think, something Julia was talking about the kind of language, and you have an interesting magic system here. There are two components that are kind of necessary. There's the kind of alphabet, being able to write in the alphabet, and so the main character basically learns this ancient alphabet. But there's also the... to kind of control the reanimated bodies of, or bones, as it were, of beings, one has to learn the body motions, the way the body is animated, and essentially write it in ink, and that becomes the source of one's powers to be able to do these, basically draw these things, and that's what animates the bodies. And I was really interested in how you came up with this idea of magic that's activated by drawing the motions.
I have been interested in art for a while, and after I started watching anime, I became interested in how animation is done, mostly traditional 2D animation, and I was like, well, maybe I can someday learn how to do this, which I really haven't. I've only made a couple, you know, very small animations just to test out how it's done, and they were pretty terrible, but fun. And while I haven't really pursued that further, I collected a bunch of books and read up on animation, and it's actually got so much depth to it because you have to be able to, you have to know anatomy, but not just anatomy, because you because it's, you know, a series of stills simulating motion. You have to know how the motion goes in. You know, is it slow in, slow out? You need to know what to exaggerate, like making portions of the body sort of bulge or shrink or whatever when an object comes to a halt. All these really fascinating things that I'd never thought about, because when I was a kid, you know, I watched cartoons like anyone does, and it never occurred to me how much work it takes to make one of these bloody animations. I remember for a vid that I made for Festivids, which is it's a sort of small fandom vidding exchange, I would did it for the old Fleischer Superman cartoons, which were, geez, they're in the public domain now, I think, and they were animated back in the 40s or something. So this is animation without computer tools or whatever. This is all drawn by hand, and yet when you look at it, the motion looks so real. And I thought about that, and I also thought about the fact that in almost every anime, when someone gets handed a giant robot to pilot, they instantly know how to work the controls. And I'm like, look, a car is relatively simple to drive, and it still is taking me some time to get the hang of it. Something that moves bipedally, because when you look at how human balance and human motion works, it's, you know, it's not a simple system. We're not really naturally balanced on two points, so the tendency is going to be to fall over. And here they are doing cartwheels and these complicated combat maneuvers and so on. And I'm like, where are these things coming from? Who is programming in the motion? I guess the short version of that is I read too much.
I think that's perfectly acceptable. Julia?
Well, clearly they're pressing the cartwheel button. That's obviously. But no, what I was going to say was going to talk about art in a different direction and art that doesn't really necessarily move. Effigy Nights has to do with sort of making people do things by using magic on artistic renderings of them that are far less work intensive on the side of like actually making their bodies move. And you said in the notes that actually comes from your childhood love of paper dolls. So I'm wondering how, like, what kinds of paper dolls did you play with? Do you still ever use them, or have you had any made for you of your stories? Has anyone ever actually like said, I love this story so much I made you paper doll fan art? And would you like them to?
I would love them to. God knows. I would do it myself, except my drawing skills are not very good. I used to, actually, I was not terribly interested in humans. I was horse crazy as a child. So I drew a herd of unicorns and cut them out, and I think a dragon and a river snake. And okay, there were two humans, but like they were two humans versus this gigantic herd of unicorns. I was into My Little Pony and unicorns and horses and pretty much all of that. But my sister and I would take these paper dolls and play with them, and we would make these fantasy adventures, and the unicorns would have a castle, which I don't understand how they got up the stairs. Maybe I don't understand horses very well. But they would have a castle, and then I would draw sheets of paper. I would draw like alchemy labs and so on, because unicorns are really good at working alchemy labs.
Clearly.
So I feel like in My Little Pony they have castles and they climb stairs, so I guess it's probably fine.
never watch that show. It's on the list of ones that I was not allowed to watch because I was supposed to be a boy. Boys didn't watch My Little Pony.
Oh, little did your parents know that bronies were coming. So just one quick question before I give it over to Paul. And that's, if someone were to make a paper doll of one of your characters or creations, what would you most like to see?
Oh gosh, pick something from Candle Art. That one's my favorite.
Okay, so listeners, you have your challenge. Everybody who's artistic, somebody better be making paper dolls of the Battle of Candle Ark.
That would be so awesome. So, Paul?
Yep. I had, going back to Conservation of Shadows for another round, I had a question about the tense. You use second person, which is not very common in or out of genres, and although it has that whole video game feel, why did you go with second person?
Well, 2 points. One, my first sale to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction was in second person, so I've always felt that the advice not to use second person is misguided and stupid. And two, Conservation of Shadows is actually in first person. It is Eresh Kigal addressing Inanna. So when she says you, she is speaking to Inanna, but it's actually in first person, and the narrative does drop into I a couple times. It's just hard to spot because at the beginning, there's no way to tell until you get to those points.
I missed that. I read it starting as second person and just locked my brain into that way. But I suppose you're right.
And one of the other stories does something like, what is the other story that uses the U? It's Between Two Dragons, I think. Yeah. Which it's a little bit more obvious that it's not second person, but it uses that. It's clear that the speaker is addressing somebody else, another person, which it's not. I don't think that's still kind of goes with that uncommon. It's not very common that you see stories written with that kind of a perspective.
I sort of feel that there are lots of pieces of rules or advice on how to do or not do writing, and especially a lot of rules on how you should not do writing, or it's too hard to do it this way or whatever. And I feel like especially new writers get intimidated away from trying things that they might benefit from trying, because you never know if something actually is a bad piece of advice or if you should not do something until you try it and you see why it should not be tried, or you actually prove that it's wrong. I'm argumentative by nature. If you tell me not to do something because it'll make the story bad, I'll be like, well, screw you. I'm going to do it and make it work. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but until I try it, I'll never know.
Yeah, it seems like there are a lot of rules that everybody knows in writing, like the show don't tell rule, which it seems like it's a useful rule to learn and how to do it, but then once you know it, you're supposed to break it. It's sort of like with grammar. You know, you learn, how to write sentences properly, and then from a writer's perspective, you start breaking that because that it creates new styles. It creates your own unique voice, and it seems like those rules, you know, you learn them, and then you figure out ways to break them, and you experiment, and that's the process. Because you can't really, like, if everybody just followed the show don't tell rule 100%, you would have so many boring books. He walked down the street. He bought a hamster. He went to the store and bought a bottle of milk. He went to bed. The end.
You just told us all that, Sean. You didn't show.
I said that, well, it's a story. I can't show you in a story, literally.
His shoes scraped the pavement as he walked down the street. One of them caught in a sticky patch of gum.
But it turned out the gum was a tentacle monster.
But then this podcast would turn out to be 16 hours long.
But yeah, but you know what I mean. Like that, the idea that, you know, that if you followed that rule 100%, it would most genre writing in particular would fall apart.
That's one of the rules I actually especially dislike because it gets trotted out so often.
Yeah, and people don't understand it, I think. I think they think it's some sort of like a universal rule, but it's actually a very complicated kind of idea.
I think people need to tell writers that laws or rules of thumb about writing are not like physical laws of the universe. I mean, for God's sake, people.
It's not physics. It's art. Learn to play around. It just comes down to experimentation. That's why I like the when people suggest that you read other writers and you kind of like mimic their style as an experiment, as a way of developing. Because I do think that doing that, even if you're only mimicking slightly or kind of borrowing grammatical structures or something, you develop out of that and find your own ways to manipulate the language. Or at least I think it works for me, but I'm nobody, so.
I think that that's how it works for a lot of people. I mean, I think that imitating other people's style helps you figure out what's comfortable for you, and your own voice ends up growing out of it. And I think that in other art forms, people are encouraged to do that a lot. I mean, people play music written by other people all the time, and people copy famous paintings. It's all part of the learning process.
John Williams is heavily influenced by, I think, late 19th century Germanic writing, particularly the works of composing, particularly the works of like Wagner. And it's obvious because that's what everybody identifies, because of the way his work is written. It deals with leitmotifs. Almost all of John Williams' work has leitmotifs. It's very rare not to have them. Whereas somebody like Howard Shore, if everything except for Lord of the Rings, if you listen to Howard Shore's music, it's the complete opposite. His music's atmospheric. It's not about identifiable themes, except for in Lord of the Rings, where you identify the themes. But yeah, but they're like polar opposites, but they're influenced by completely different musical traditions. And yeah, I don't know.
And yet writing is different. If you imitate authors, that's either considered pastiche or gauche or not done, even though, as we pointed out, it's a way to help develop your own voice and your own skills.
But I think everybody imitates, don't they?
Yeah, but there seems to be a stigma about it in writing, at least a overt stigma about doing that, whereas as opposed to other artistic disciplines.
I wonder if people realize that like half of all the writing written today is influenced by Hemingway. I'm sorry.
So going back to Yoon's collection, I have a question about the overall collection, and that's, how did you choose which stories to put in, and did you arrange the order yourself, or did your editor help you with that, and how did that happen?
Okay, so what happened was that I made a list of stories that I thought made sense to go in the collection together, and then my editor, Sean Wallace, made his list of what to put in the collection that would go together, and we looked at the two lists. They agreed on, I think, all but maybe three items or something. They agreed very well, and we went with his version because I felt that he had more experience and his experience would be a better guide. Then later on, he wanted to include Effigy Knights. That was after I had turned in the Easel's Lexicon, so it was getting close to a publication date, but he wanted to include Effigy Knights, and I said, well, you know, if you're going to include Effigy Knights, can I also include Candle Arc, because I won't shut up about Candle Arc? And he's like, but Yoon, you have too much military stuff in here already. And I said, please. And he was really nice and let me include it. As for the ordering, Sean did that. He had said something about helping me do it, and then I'm told him that I actually have no idea whatsoever how you arrange books in a collection or an anthology or anything, really. It's just this completely mysterious thing, other than the first one should be good and the last one should be good, so maybe all the sucky ones can be in the middle or something. I don't know. But Sean pretty much took care of that, and the first I knew of the order was when the PDF arrived in my inbox for proofreading.
Okay, so you've mentioned twice now that Candle Arc is your favorite. Why? What do you love about it?
Because the protagonist is a character that I am using in the novel that I'm shopping around, and I am really fond of him.
Oh, that's interesting. So we may have a novel from you in the future.
Well, that's assuming someone wants the novel, but you know.
They're going to want it. Don't worry. Some legs are going to get broken. It's going to happen. I don't know. I don't have that kind of power. It would be really scary if you found out, like, you know, editors in New York are having their legs broken.
Disclaimer, Sean does not break people's legs. The Stiffy and Fanti show disavows all knowledge of any broken legs that might happen due to Sean.
I might send a dead gopher, though.
Please don't.
No, that's now illegal, I think.
As an editor, can I just say, never ever send someone a dead gopher.
I won't, I promise. But that's actually really exciting that we, at least, you know, the hope that we got to, because I really enjoyed this collection. As I said, I want to teach one of your stories now, so clearly I love the stories. But I really enjoyed the collection. I would love to see some of these worlds, like, expanded into, you know, a novel to have that kind of a different vision. Because novels and short stories are so drastically different, even though they're both fiction, the kinds of perspectives are different, and I think that'd be really interesting. So hopefully that happens, and means all the publishers who listen to this show need to, you know, gobble it up. Or Word. Else. Anyway, okay, so does anyone have any questions, any remaining questions about the book?
Nope, I'm good. I think I can stand pat.
Okay, Julia?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories we haven't talked about, so there's plenty of stuff that people can go check out.
And should.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I just told my friend who's working on, I told her earlier today that she's working on, like, typography and narratology and science fiction, and I was like, you know what? This is a collection she should be reading. So hopefully she will go buy it. So last two questions, which are kind of awkward ending ones, which is, what can we expect from you in the near future, such as, you know, do you have any short stories that are coming out we should know about, or are you going to make any convention appearances, that sort of thing?
I will be at ReaderCon in July.
It's Yay, on July, I'll be there too.
It's on July something. I would
it's,
have
it's
to look
July
it up.
It's July 15th, I think.
And allegedly, I will be on panels if I actually respond to the survey that they sent me in, which I've been avoiding assiduously. And I will actually also be giving a talk on the web, the sort of narrative web game that I made for Fail Better Games, which was called Winter Strike.
Oh, excellent.
The other thing is that I have a short story coming out in Lightspeed in August, and it has stuff to do with games and maybe some math.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. So we have that to look up for. Do you know when that's going to be released?
August?
August.
Oh, okay. Yeah. She said August, didn't she?
She said
yes. She did.
What pronouns do you prefer, Yoon?
You're welcome to use either.
Because I know you said you didn't identify as female, so I feel like calling you she without asking is kind of rude of us.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh.
No,
oh.
It's all good. I'm not really... I'll answer to either. It's just awkward because I live in a conservative area, so... Mm.
Okay. Well, awesome, and I look forward to seeing you at ReaderCon. I will definitely be there, so if you happen to see me, say hello.
Will do.
Excellent. So I this will be fairly easy, but where can folks find you online?
I think I have not... Sheesh. I haven't updated my website in months. Yeah. My website is yoonhalee.com, yoonhalee.com, and my email address, which... anyone is welcome to do because the spammers are already doing it, is yoon@yoonhalee.com.
Excellent. We should mention too that the collection comes out from Prime Books, which they're actually really quite excellent. They've had a lot of really amazing collections, so you should go get it. I'm correct in assuming it is, I have an ebook, but I'm assuming it's in almost every format imaginable, except maybe like Space Monkey language. but everyone should definitely go check it out. Really recommend it, particularly if you are a short story enthusiast. These are some really good short stories, and you know, you should support Prime Books because they're the little guys and they're awesome.
I'm holding out for my cuneiform tablet version, especially of Conservation of Shadows.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Yoon, for coming on our show and dealing with me being a moron. And it was really great, and I appreciate it.
Sure thing. It was my pleasure.
Well, and we will see everybody whenever we come back.
Night, everyone.
Night.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.